This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington, in for Neil Conan. Anybody growing up with a brother or sister knows that the relationship between siblings can be complicated. For example, there's the expectations placed on an older child. There's the struggle of younger siblings to distinguish themselves. And in the effort to find a place in the family dynamics, sibling rivalry can get fierce. So what happens when a sibling is sick, disabled, or troubled? There's a lot out there on how to cope with a difficult child, but often children who seem problem-free compared to their siblings might not get the correct attention that they need. Psychotherapist Jean Safer drew on her own complicated relationship with her brother to research problems in sibling relationships. Surprisingly, she found little to guide her. The result of her work is her book called The Normal One, Life with a Difficult or Damaged Sibling. Safer says psychotherapists concentrate too much on the parent-child relationship and all too often ignore the troubled child's effects on his or her family. Are you the sibling of an impaired brother or sister? What is your relationship like? How did it affect the family dynamics? How did that relationship shape who you are? Perhaps you are the normal one. Give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Author and practicing psychotherapist Jean Safer joins me now from our New York Bureau. Welcome to Talk of the Nation, Jean.
Delighted to be here.
Just as a point of disclosure, I am an only child, so you listeners, you're going to have to help me out here. Jean, let's begin.
I bet you know some normal ones, though.
I think I do. So let me talk to you. What are your experiences like? Now, I find in the acknowledgments in the front of your book, you thank a friend who once told you that you'd have to write about your brother someday.
Yes, a friend and colleague of mine who had an idea before I had an idea that my brother was a bigger problem in my life than I realized. And like many so-called normal ones, because we're not totally normal, I didn't notice this so much. I mean, I knew he had problems, but I had no idea of the intense ongoing impact on my life long after we didn't live under the same roof. And there are many, many people out there who have these issues.
People, you write, didn't even know that you had a brother, one who was 7 years older than you were. Now, how did that happen?
Because I didn't mention him. And because psychically, in some way, I had a delete key in my psyche before we had delete keys on computers. What's remarkable is so many people in my own field have brothers and sisters, as I found out when I talked to them, that I never knew about. They never use their names. It is truly an invisible and, I would say, almost ubiquitous phenomenon. How many people are embarrassed by their brothers and sisters, are afraid to be associated with them, and at the same time feel that this has had a profound and silent impact on their lives. They've been invisible for much too long.
As a therapist, is your own behavior and behavior and the choices of your colleagues odd to you?
Tremendously, particularly since I'm trained as a psychoanalyst. And as you probably know, psychoanalysts think that early life is the most important thing that determines our whole world. And to find that when I started to research this, I found virtually nothing in my own field. And a wonderful little anecdote is I looked at the index to the standard edition of Freud, the father of psychoanalysis. It's a 404-page book. And there is no reference to siblings. There are a couple, I think there are 5 references to brothers and sisters. However, I was very pleased to find that there is a reference to Siberia. And my personal fantasy is that that's where all the siblings get exiled.
To Siberia.
So I called one of my chapters Everybody's an Only Child.
Tell me this. Go ahead.
This, by the way, affects people who have normal siblings also. We all want to be only children in some way. But those of us who have abnormal siblings really cannot bear to think about how much we want to be only children. That's the point.
Tell us a little bit about your brother, Stephen. Give us a picture of your home life when you were small.
Well, my brother was never diagnosed with anything, and that is not uncommon. He was one of those kids who never made it quite. He had difficulties in school. He had difficulties socially. He had difficulties with weight. I think probably now he would have been called learning disabled. And then he had major problems with anger, which were never dealt with by my parents. He was kind of separated in some ways, and I was 7 years younger, and I became the repository of all of my parents' hopes and dreams, which felt fine at the time in some ways. And it's only much later that I realized how much he is a part of me and how sorry I am that I was never able to have a relationship with him. It's been a very important and painful journey to realize. He also, as an adult, became physically handicapped. And that was another terrible blow. And I think that many of us, normal ones, are sad because we've been deprived by fate and by our family circumstances from having real sibling relationships that are equal.
You talk as that he, when he grew up and left your parents' home and went out to make a life for himself, that he was a fabulous musician. He had
this
wonderful talent.
Yes. Yes, he does and still does. And this was the one thing that, in fact, we all in my family did. I wasn't such a fabulous musician, but this was appreciated by my parents. And one of the things that's very important is I don't want to indict anybody in this, that people come with their own histories, their own traumas, and we all struggle. And parents who treat children in ways that turn out to be traumatic are not doing it most often out of malign impulses. They're doing it because they can't help it. And very often they think they're doing the right thing.
Some people may be wondering if, in the context of this conversation, you're looking to create a new class of victims.
That is the last thing I ever want to do. I think the Suffering Olympics is very populated, and I don't want to add to it. And what's very interesting, and the reason that I think this topic is so important, is these people do not call attention to themselves. They do the opposite. They need to call more attention to themselves. They're really the invisible helpers, most of these people. And whatever issues they have in terms of their personalities, and I identified four characteristics in the 60 people that I talked to, of all.
And,
all ages, and all kinds of...
And what characteristics are these?
Well, these characteristics are premature maturity, the compulsion to achieve, survivor guilt, and fear of contagion.
That you're going to get it? Or become it?
Yes, yes. Even if it's not genetic, by the way. Mm-hmm. It's a psychological fear of contamination. Sometimes it's expressed as fear that your children will get it. And this can be things like mental retardation, you know, which you're not going to get.
Right.
And it has to do with your experience of your connection to your brother and sister. That's my favorite quality of what I call the Caliban syndrome, after the fascinating character of Caliban and his relationship with Miranda in Shakespeare's The Tempest, which I write about. They're the kind of archetypal brother and sister that I'm thinking about. Fear of contagion is so important because this is the way that you both repudiate your brother and sister and feel over-identified with them. And I saw this so often. But the compulsion to achieve is also very, very important, that you've got to achieve for two, that you're only as good as your last failure. You have to become an adult way before any child is an adult. You have to be independent. You have to be cheerful. You have to be good. You have to be smart. And the survivor guilt, which I think no normal child is exempt from, is the question of why was I spared? Why do I, how can I deserve health, happiness, success when I see my brother and sister can never have those things? And these are things that every normal child, in my opinion, has to struggle with, recognize, acknowledge, and work through.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation on NPR News. We turn to Amy in Shingle House, Pennsylvania. Welcome
Hi.
To the program, Amy.
Thank you very much. My brother had an accident when he was 16. He had had some just kind of normal adolescent problems before his accident, and then after his accident, he had had a brain injury. He still has, he's 37, and he has just some anger problems. He's grossly obese. He has just kind of a number of psychiatric type of problems.
Mm-hmm.
So when he had his accident, my parents were gone. I stayed with a neighbor the entire time he was in the hospital. And then when, of course, I went to school, everybody was saying, how is he, how is he, how is he?
Before they asked about you, right?
I was in seventh grade.
Uh-huh.
I basically disappeared.
Uh-huh.
And from that time, I think, I mean, I'm smart enough, but my brother is brilliant. He was a valedictorian of his class, but I think I overcompensated in a way by becoming extremely athletic.
How interesting. So you found, do you feel guilty about becoming an athlete?
I don't feel guilty, but my brother is horribly jealous of me. I am married, I have four kids, and he lives with my parents, and he's always saying, Amy has such a great life. She's got just, everything is so perfect. And it's not perfect. You know, I'm the first one to tell you it's not perfect. But he thinks I live in some ivory tower.
Mm-hmm. And there's no way to get through, is there, about that? Because in some ways your life is much better than his and always will be. The point is that it's not your fault.
No, it isn't. But I guess in a way I feel guilty because I have four kids and I weigh 105 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he has no kids and he's 5'6 and he weighs like 250, 260 pounds.
Do you worry about your weight ever?
I had an eating disorder. I still struggle with an eating disorder.
You see, that's that fear of contagion. Because of your brother in a certain way, if you gain 5 pounds, it's like gaining 500 pounds.
Oh, my gosh. You're going to make me cry because I'm serious.
I hope it's good crying.
I honestly never realized that. I thought it was because that horrible boy in my science class picked on me.
Well, I'm sure the horrible boy had something to do with it, but I bet your brother had more to do with it.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, is there something that Amy should do, perhaps?
Yes, Amy should realize that what she's suffering from is not an extra 5 pounds, but she's suffering from the Caliban syndrome, which is this, and the fear of contagion is a very big part of her life. And I think if she looks at this and thinks about it, maybe she won't be so hard on herself.
Let's turn to Michelle in Syracuse, New York. Welcome to Talk of the Nation, Michelle.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well.
Listen to you guys all the time.
Great.
Okay, I have a brother who's Down syndrome, and he was a middle sibling.
Mm-hmm. Are you older or younger?
I'm the youngest.
Mm-hmm.
So he was the middle sibling. But I think what I went through was more of my father reacting to it, you know, giving my mother a hard time.
Each family is different.
Yes, they are. Each family is different. But, you know, I think I spend time with my brother, do things with him. And, you know, so I think it more, like, affected my father. My father wasn't ready for a child like that.
You know, I bet it affected you, too.
Yeah.
If you look at yourself, I bet you'll find that it affected you.
Yeah, it did.
In what ways?
I just felt bad for my mother, you know.
Mm.
You know, for my father giving her a hard time and, you know.
Did she tell you a lot about what a hard time he gave her?
Yes. I mean, just recently she did. You know, because, you know, I'm old now. And
right, but you saw it, you know, during your childhood. Did that, maybe that made you feel a little responsible for your mother and to be extra special good and make her feel good so that she wouldn't feel
right.
So bad. Is that true?
Yes, it is true.
Uh-huh. So that, there. Now, guess what? You suffer from the Caliban syndrome, too. You have premature maturity.
Right.
This is amazing. We have found a couple of women who have called in. They're discussing issues where they clearly have identified with the four things that you've listed as part of the Caliban syndrome. Why don't you list some of those again, Jean?
Okay. They are premature maturity, compulsion to achieve, survivor guilt, and fear of contagion. Not everybody has every one of them, but if you look at yourself and you're a normal one, I am willing to bet that you will find some of this. At least the 60 people I talked to, and certainly yours truly, found all of it.
Should people turn more to their therapists for help, or do you think that they can start by picking up your book?
I would love them to pick up my book and then show it to their therapists, because sometimes therapists don't realize these things.
We're talking about growing up with a troubled sibling. We're also taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. Send us email at totn@npr.org. I'm Corva Coleman. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Thank you. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington, in for Neil Conan. We're talking about what happens to the normal child in families with a troubled or an ill sibling. My guest is Jean Safer, author of The Normal One, Life with a Difficult or Damaged Sibling. Were you a problem-free child with a difficult sibling? How did that shape who you were? Join our discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK, our email address, totn@npr.org. Jean, as we're talking about sibling relationships, I'd like to ask you about your own relationship with your brother, but more particularly about your relationship with your father and your brother's relationship with your father. What was that like?
Oh, that was quite a complicated thing, and I had to really recover it with great difficulty because I had so few memories of my father and my brother even interacting. And I realized that that really was the core of the problem, that I think before I was born, my father in some ways gave up on my brother and turned to me, the adorable, as you said, problem-free, problem-free child, to be his son. So he really, I think he was uncomfortable with my brother. I think he didn't know how to deal with his problems. I think my brother embarrassed my father, which is very often the case in these families. One of the parents can be embarrassed. Sometimes if it's a major disability, the father won't be seen with the child. There can be some terrible things. And when I came along, I was the answer to everybody's prayers, at least on the surface. You know, the kid who does well in school and looks fine and does fine. And of course, this was more of a burden and a source of anxiety than I ever had any idea. And I only realized that when I started writing this book, really. I wrote the book to try to come to terms and try to understand my brother and to appreciate him and our relationship. That's really what it's about. And then to see how much these things affected other people.
We turn to Eric in Gilbert, Arizona. Welcome to Talk of the Nation, Eric.
Thank you for taking my call.
Do you have a question?
Yeah. Well, it's not more a question, it's more of a kind of discussion for you.
Mm-hmm.
My older sister was born deaf, and she was traditionally the achiever. She got better grades in school, did more sports and athletics, and had more friends. And to the world, she was the abnormal one, the fighter, and I was the normal one who just did what I was expected to do. But in my family, I was the abnormal one.
Does that often happen?
There are so many variations on this. It's fascinating. Clearly, you were kind of left to your own devices in some way, and an awful lot of aspirations and compensations were put into your sister.
Do you think that that happens to others, and would this also be part of a Caliban syndrome?
Well, very often, I did talk to some people where the child who had the problems was the focus of attention and also the source of pride, either because of the disability and how strong or courageous they were, or because they had some other talent. And sometimes the normal one was just kind of left on the side. I had one woman who was only given birthday presents that her brother was also given. Even when she graduated from college, she didn't get anything special. He was always the darling golden one. So it can happen. You know, whether you're too central or too peripheral, it's still a problem.
Has your brother read your book by any chance, Jean?
I don't know.
Do you think you'll ever be able to find out?
It's a source of sorrow for me. I don't know whether he could understand it in terms of what I was trying to talk about our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried to approach him many times, and that the last year he really has not called me. So I don't know. I think I would know if he read it.
Does he communicate with you?
No. Mm. You know, I really do. I would hope that he would read it because I made real efforts to grieve for what both of us lost. And I did have one conversation with him a couple of years ago when I was thinking about this topic. And I said that it was unfair the way we were both treated, and particularly that he was treated. And he seemed surprised by that. And it was unspeakably unfair, although I'm not writing the book out of guilt at this point. I hope I work through a lot of my guilt. I'm really writing it to understand this whole phenomenon and to be an advocate for those who have not been spoken up for.
We turn to Dana in Old Saybrook, Connecticut. Welcome to Talk of the Nation, Dana.
Hi, thanks. I really appreciate your having this topic. I bought the book
the normal one. There really is not a lot out there, and I'm enjoying reading it. And I haven't finished yet, but I'm calling as a mother.
Oh, how interesting.
Yes, with three young children, 4, 8, and 9, and the middle one has fairly significant kind of undiagnosed global development delays, mental retardation, a lot of behavioral issues.
Uh-huh.
I guess I kind of wanted to ask some preemptive advice so that
Bravo.
My normal ones will hopefully not be in the position to feel like I made a lot of mistakes.
Oh, and, bravo for you. I'm so impressed.
Specifically, I think it's difficult to make sure that I'm not giving subliminal messages to the other ones when I have them behave certain ways to not set the middle one off. And it's difficult to gauge when you're in the middle of things what the impact of the
Well, I have to say
is.
That your consciousness has already been raised that you're concerned about that. And the best thing that you can do is to think about that. I do have on my website, by the way, a page of advice called Do's and Don'ts for Parents of Children with and Without Disabilities. And I recommend that you look at that. Maybe it'll give you some hints about how to avoid some of these pitfalls. But you've already taken a huge step, which is to be aware.
Right.
And another thing that you could do is to think about your own childhood, by the way. And did you have brothers and sisters yourself?
Yeah, one sister.
Think about how your parents dealt with the two of you and your relationship with your sister and what you might be projecting onto your children. That's another tip for you. And bravo, I think it's brave and wise for you to be asking these questions, and you will save your children a lot of grief and maybe make the next generation not have to read this book.
Right. Well, keep writing, and I'll get to your website. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, while we're at it, Jean, why don't you tell us your website address?
It's called thenormalone.com, or my name, which is JeannieSaferPhD.com. There's an interview, a kind of extensive interview about why I wrote the book. There's an excerpt, there's a chapter from the book, and there's a page of advice for parents. I've talked a lot to pediatricians who are interested in helping parents avoid some of these pitfalls with their children, just like our very thoughtful last caller. And I hope that this can be helpful to parents. I'm very cheered that parents are interested in it, because the biggest problem with the generation of people that I talk to is that their parents didn't see that they were doing anything. And once your consciousness is raised a little bit, you can make such a difference to your children. There's really a very hopeful message here, which is if you think about things, it doesn't have to just happen automatically. Your past just doesn't have to rule you
in
the way you deal with your children.
We turn to Kathleen in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I hope that you can hear me okay. Minneapolis is kind of the Bermuda Triangle for cell phone service. So I'm calling just to comment. I'm the eldest, actually, of six, and two of the middle siblings have bipolar disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And just to comment on myself being the eldest, but then also my sister, who is the youngest, and just we're all very involved. My mother is a mental health educator and works with mm-hmm. the National Alliance of the Mentally Ill.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all very fairly involved with that, with NAMI, which is the National Alliance of Mentally Ill. And just
mm-hmm.
in the last year, at the national conference was held in Minneapolis this year, and myself and my mother both spoke on siblings and coping with mental illness. Because
oh, excellent.
You're really right that this is an ignored population. The siblings, the
mm-hmm.
quote
that you're the ignored
problem.
Population.
What's that?
That you're the ignored population,
yes.
In a sense.
Right. Well, and the quote-unquote problem three, which I think is
yes.
not quite true, but and I think
absolutely not.
Right. And I think the symptoms that you being afraid of getting it and all of that is absolutely true, and the guilt. My youngest sibling, who actually is 13 years younger than me, even though she's 13 years younger than me, she is closer to me in terms of maturity.
Oh, sure.
And
at least you have each other, which is good.
Right, right. And we are also, my parents have always been very, very proactive in trying to educate not only us, but everyone else, too, about mental illness and always talking about it in our family. But I think to know even with that, impact is strong, and I think particularly
mm-hmm.
With bipolar and some of their mental illnesses is kind of living with the thought that if we don't do enough, one of our siblings will commit suicide.
Oh, what an incredible burden to have.
It is, but it's also a very real, I mean,
oh, yes.
the reality of mental illness and of bipolar specifically.
Go ahead.
It is a very strong burden, and I think both of us feeling that, though, kind of on a daily basis. And also, I think, communicating it to just the general population of what that's like.
Well, you know, I want to say something else about that, which is that why should it be your responsibility to keep your brother or sister from committing suicide? This is a huge, this is a huge thing to have to do, and nobody could do it, as far as we know.
Right, right. No, and I don't see it as
it's
my
a fantasy, personal, you know.
Right, right. And then and I don't see it as my personal responsibility, and I don't believe my sister does either. Mm-hmm. But I think on a head level we don't, but on a heart level.
Right.
That.
Well, that's where survivor guilt and all of these things come in. I'm also wondering whether, is there anything in your life that is not related to bipolar disorder, you know, that in your family? I mean, I know that it's wonderful that your mother is so involved in this, but is there anything that's like just yours, I mean, that doesn't have to do with having to educate people about mental illness or things like this? I think that's a very important thing for you to have.
Right.
Just fun.
And absolutely. And our family is, and I actually have two small children of my own, and they, I would say at the family gatherings, they're probably the focus because they're such just delightful, small people. And
do you allow yourself to be very happy that your children are okay without guilt? Congratulations, then.
I also do live in fear that they will, I mean, before my husband and I had children, we got genetic counseling.
That's wise. With a thing that has a genetic disorder.
I have a question here, and that is that it's interesting that Kathleen's calling and speaking about this, but we're getting tons of emails. I'm sorry, we just won't be able to get to all of them. But there are a lot of people asking you, Jeannie, for advice. I mean, do you really sense that there's a dearth of information such that people don't know where to turn?
Oh, absolutely. There's a hunger for this. There's a desperate need through parents and also through siblings. They want to do the right thing. They want to understand. They want to take care of their siblings or their children. Yes, absolutely. And I hope the book provides some of this. I hope the advice that I'm giving in the book and on the website will help people at least, first of all, realize they're not alone. Realize that some of these personality characteristics that they have there's nothing abnormal about being the normal one, if you know what I mean. That your anxieties and your fears, you can identify them and they don't have to rule you. If you look at these things, it can help you later. I mean, these are profound things. It's not, obviously one page of advice isn't going to make the difference, but I think it's a start just to identify this. That's the thing.
Here's an email from Jessica Carpell, who writes to us saying that she has a son with severe ADD and oppositional defiance and a daughter who is 17 months older than that, and she calls her the polar opposite of her son, and she wants to know, what can she do to help their relationship along?
Not try so hard to help the relationship along. let the normal one have a life of her own. That's what I'm talking about. I think parents are so hoping that the two children will get along. If you do the right thing and help your child who's normal have the center of attention when he or she deserves it, or, you know, to spend some time separately, they'll have naturally a decent relationship with their brother and sister. You don't have to do anything. You have to not do certain things. You have to not do things like, be sure to include your brother in everything you do. I call this the take Susie along syndrome, by the way. That's what she can do.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Jeannie, are there images in popular culture that represent the way normal ones and damaged siblings interact? Perhaps we're picking up on some of these from the media.
Oh, my goodness, yes. There is such a saccharine, sentimental notion of the loving, helpful bond between the normal and the abnormal or impaired sibling. And sometimes it's true, and that's wonderful when it's true. But have you ever noticed that whenever there's any article, and there's no newspaper, including my beloved New York Times, that is exempt from this, there is always the epithet supportive in this, when you describe the sibling. It's like a Homeric epithet. You know,
what Homeric.
Yes, like wine, the wine dark sea, you know, the supportive sibling. Sometimes siblings don't feel supportive, and they are entitled not to always feel supportive. And sometimes your life doesn't revolve around your sibling, and sometimes you don't want to be the caretaker. One woman I interviewed said, I don't want to go into special ed. Who signed me up? You know, and this is something that people who have normal, healthy siblings never realize. Well, of course you'll take care of your sibling. Well, sometimes people can't or won't, and they should have choices in their life. You should not have to be, your sibling should not have to be the center of your universe forever. Obviously they're part of you, and you need to understand, but sometimes you need things that are all your own.
What happens if there's a sudden trauma? Suddenly, that happens to a sibling. Everything's fine, and all of a sudden, boom, there's an accident. How important is it for the family, the whole family, to face it head on?
I believe that facing how you feel about things is always, if not the first order of business, the second. First, you have to deal with it, with the emergency. But then to think about the impact of it. I think it's very important for parents, for instance, to explain to the non-involved child, to the one who doesn't have some terrible emergency, that this is not about them, that it's not going to happen to them, to make sure that, for instance, if a child has a severe illness or something, to not just give presents to the child who's in the hospital. I cannot tell you how many times this is done. To try to keep some sense that your normal child is okay and it's all right not to be concerned 100% with the sibling's needs, that you still, even if your brother has a brain tumor, you still deserve help with your homework, and you still deserve to want your parents' attention. It has to do with feelings. It's not that children can't understand or don't accept that a parent has to spend time with a disabled or troubled child. It's that they're supposed to, the normal one is supposed to not need anything. And that it should be, they should be just like the parents, that it should be totally fine, and that they should have no distress about it, no anger about it. Parents are very threatened by their normal children's anger.
Are you seeing new research now about siblings?
I'm seeing that there are a few more books about siblings, which I'm thrilled about. That since I wrote The Normal One, several siblings have come forward and written about their own experiences. And I'm hoping that there's a little consciousness raising going on and that this subject is finally not so taboo. I mean, for years we kept the handicapped in the closet, and now hopefully the feelings of their normal brothers and sisters are coming out. And I say that's excellent.
What about,
so I hope that there will be more and more about this.
What about any research on whether the dynamic is different if a child is adopted rather than blood-related?
You know, that's an interesting topic. It's come up several times that several colleagues of mine are thinking about this. There's virtually no research on abnormal siblings to begin with. That's why I did it myself. There's very little that's in-depth that's not surveys or things like that I'm familiar with. One of the questions that I get very often from scientific kinds of audiences like physicians is, well, what is the difference if the child is a male or female, or if it's a cardiac problem versus a cancer, or if it's the firstborn versus the tenth born? And I have an answer to that, which is that it all depends on the role of the children and the family for the parents and the meaning that these disabilities or problems or lack of problems have for the parents.
I'd like to thank you, Jeannie. Jeannie Safer is a writer and psychotherapist in private practice in New York City. Her book is called The Normal One, Life with a Difficult or Damaged Sibling. Thanks, Jeannie, so much.
I'm delighted to have been here.
Coming up after the break, we talk about China's plans to launch its first manned space flight. That's supposed to happen next week. If you've got questions, give us a call now, 1-800-989-TALK. I'm Korva Coleman. It is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.